everyone, welcome to episode 44 of HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate on Twitter. Xerxes couldn't make it, as he's busy dishonoring the Uburo clan with poorly timed jump kicks. My panelists today are...
I'm Bobinator.
And I'm Satan.
On this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two, you can nominate one game via a five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. We've stopped accepting nominations via Twitter for the foreseeable future. Rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but don't nominate games with already ranked. You can see the master list for yourself. Check out bit.ly/47kgames. Our next game is Dungeon Master, published, developed by FTL Games. It was released for the Atari ST as the lead platform, and then pretty much anything that would run video games. Its earliest release date and territory was December 15, 1987 in North America. Gotta make that Christmas release, really get in there, you know, hopefully... parents will buy it for their kids as last-minute gifts.
It's basically 1988. It's close enough.
It was nominated by at Jacko Javinen. So, Dungeon Master, probably up there as one of the most generic names for a video game ever. Also, you don't even play as the master of the dungeon. This isn't a dungeon keeper situation. This is... more of a dungeon explorer situation, which incidentally is the name of a game, but this is Dungeon Master, but your goal is to master the dungeon by beating it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that the title of the game is a kind of false advertising. I was expecting a simulator where you get to play as like a 13-year-old nerd sitting at a table and you get to command your own D&D game and be the dungeon master and make up the rules as you go along. And, like, the objective would be to cheat to win, like, tell everybody, you need to roll a 25 in order to win. Oh,
so basically be like that one episode of Dexter's Laboratory.
Yes, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Dexter's such a jerk in that.
That is bit advanced for a 1987-88 game.
Yeah.
There's a game that's like that, some... Dungeons and Dragons type indie game. I can't remember the name of it exactly, but where it was a D&D campaign rather than an actual game. This is the original-ish first-person dungeon crawler that, and by original-ish, I mean, this is the one, almost a template game that kind of threw out the really clunky games before it and reinvigorated the whole genre and blew everyone away when it came out.
Yeah, this wasn't the first of its type, but it was definitely the codifier.
I would say, like, if we're talking, like, the features introduced, definitely the first of type, it probably very much was inspired by games like, say, Wizardry, but it has a very different style of play that's very unique.
What wasn't Akalabeth, like, the free Ultima, also in 3D?
Well, it was, but I don't think it was real time, at least not the extent that this game is.
Well, Dungeon Master is real time in the sense that enemies move as you move. And if you stand still, enemies keep moving, which is a kind of an interesting step. This isn't real time 3D in the way that Ultima Underground is real time 3D, in that it's actually, you know, kind of 3D.
Hey, remind me, was Opetus in real time also? I don't remember.
Similar in gameplay, I guess you could technically say.
Well, I like Dungeon Master more than Opetus, so yeah. Let's move on.
So you mind if I summarize the game real quick?
Go ahead.
There is a story, I don't remember it because it's the manual, and it's 20 pages long. It's,
oh boy.
I don't remember being very exceptional for your standard fantasy RPG game in the 80s, but...
It's basically, it exists to explain why you're in a dungeon dicking around. That is the plot.
So basically, what you do is you go into this dungeon, you gather four party members, there are a whole bunch, there's like a werewolf, there's like a lizard person, I always appreciate that. There's some kind of Wookiee, I guess? You got a lot of choices that may all have like their own different abilities and such.
You can also recruit humans if you want.
Oh, screw that. Come on, why'd you do that when you have all these awesome beast men?
It's interesting and worth mentioning that it's a very cool interface for recruiting party members. You don't just hit a roll party button. Instead, you actually walk around a miniature dungeon floor and interact with their portraits on the walls. And it says, like, well, this is Beast Man Wolfface. And you're like, cool, that sounds good to me. I'll add them to my party. And you get to add... It's three extra characters, correct? Just to be sure, you've got yourself. You have to play as the person that you are. You know, you don't make a fresh party of four, I don't think. Or am I confusing? Because there's several versions of this game, and some of them handle it a little differently.
In the Atari ST version, you pick four. There are other versions of this game where you have a character that you always have with you, and you pick three. But this version, it is four.
In the original game, it is four.
Once you actually have all four party members, the dungeon itself goes on for, I want to say, like 13 or 14 different floors. It's mostly trying to find your way to the exit, dealing with the various puzzles and, of course, monsters that you encounter.
Now, it's worth noting that, contrary to what you may believe, the game is not randomly generated. This is a handcrafted one dungeon that... Everyone explores it, you get the same dungeon, it doesn't change every time, it's just basically the same thing. So instead, it's full of actual puzzles and little memorable areas that have been put together. So, you know, there are pressure tiles, and when you step on them, they open doors, or when you step off them, they go back up and they close doors, so you gotta actually place objects on top of them to hold them down, which is really, really interesting.
And that's another thing I want to talk about. This game has a really cool interface for, let's call it early 1988. There is no typing. You do not use the keyboard. Everything is controlled with the mouse. Everything is handled basically visually, I would say. Like, if you want to drop something, you have to open up your inventory, click it, and move it down onto the screen where you want it to go. And I'd say, compared to a lot of other games or of the time, where you might have to use like every key in the keyboard to do everything, that is a really unique way of handling it.
I wouldn't describe it as a efficient interface. You know, it's not going to be the maximum efficiency hotkey interface. But it is probably one of the more immersive interfaces that you can get, especially for the time. You actually feel like you're physically... You know, I got to move my items from my backpack to my equipment. I've got to put an item on the screen, so I just put on the screen. If you want to fill up your flask of water, you have to click the flask, drag it to the water, fill it up. And then you can shove it in your character's face, a little picture of their mouth, and then they'll actually make like a like face. It's
I'm not sure if I can qualify this, but would you say that this interface is generally easier to understand than, like, most of Sierra's adventure games around this time? Well, they mostly had text parsers, so I guess it's kind of a different beast, but, no, for its time, you know, it's pretty easy to understand, and without being too incredibly complex for the most part.
I'd say this one it works really well because it's an intuitive interface, you know?
Yes.
You're like, I need to do this, what happens? Well, if I click this, and then I just move it, it works. It's like, wow, it actually did the thing that I thought it was going to do, which is, it's difficult to appreciate in 88 how handy that is to have an interface that responds in the way that you would intuitively expect it to respond. We're in the year 2017, which makes this game technically 30 years old. It hasn't actually reached that yet, but it's almost there.
Yeah.
And... wow, you know, that's like really impressive for then. Like, now you expect the game to be intuitive. Now you expect it all to make sense. And you expect the game to basically forcibly teach you everything without needing to even pay attention, you know.
How do you explain I Divine Cybermancy? Okay, that game's neither here nor there. But I did want to say, though, that probably the most complex it gets is that you have to keep your characters well-nourished, or they'll plop because they have their own food and water meters.
That is something I think they could have handled better.
Yeah.
I understand the reasoning. They don't want you to stay in one place and heal up and be able to grind forever. They want you to keep moving, but I think maybe it would have been better if you, like, one timer bar that you had to refill every so often. Like, having, like, two bars for everybody you have to micromanage is kind of overdoing it,
yeah,
I would say.
That's probably, I want to say, the most old school this game gets in its difficulty. Because, yeah, like you said, it's just, like, more management than could have been consolidated.
Like,
and
they already have the torches. You have to keep picking those up, keep having light going. That would have been enough of a pressure to keep moving forward.
That's how Shadowgate handled it, come to think of it. And yeah, I do think that, like, that the food and water, while, like, you know, relatively realistic, it, I don't know, it didn't need to be there. I mean, what can we say about this game being difficult besides those meters?
It can get very difficult because this is a game that has all of those nice elemental things. You know, some enemies will be stronger or weaker against certain weapons or magics, yeah, and things. So you can get enemies, and I believe the mummies in this game are infamous for this, where they're weak to, I think, fire magic, and they pretty much are invulnerable to a lot of other things. So if you don't know the fire magic, or you don't really have the ability to use it, we can talk about the magic sex sort of in a second, but, you know, then they'll just kick your ass and you just be like, what, huh? Yeah. But on the upside, you can avoid plenty of enemies if you're lucky. You know, you can actually run away, and that's pretty cool, you know, that.
I almost want to say this game's almost like a survival horror game at some points, because it does have, you know, admittedly, it's a bit of a creepy atmosphere. Like, these things shuffling in real time, I've always found slightly unnerving in a way, but, like, you can also just kind of run by them. It's like a, I don't know, I want to say maybe survival horror took a little influence from what Dungeon Master set forth. Besides, you know, all the actual dungeon crawling games, like Phantasy Star, for example. Its dungeons are on 3D, so. But
well, the great thing is, yeah, as you said, you aren't locked into place when enemies are in front of you necessarily. Sometimes you can run away and that sort of thing, which is nice, you know, to actually feel like you're in a fight, you're in a situation. You know, your solution in a lot of games is to just keep fighting, or hitting the run button and hoping that the game says, all right, fine, run away this time, and then the enemy just evaporate and then you never see them again. Whereas in this game, you run away, they're still there waiting for you, and they'll even be following you, like, come back here, because I'm going to kick your ass.
I'm not sure if enemies respawn or not. I
think there are certain enemies or areas that enemies respawn in, but otherwise, yes, I believe that enemies stay dead.
Combat is kind of neat, too. It's kind of got, like, a... you have to keep your party's position in mind, because you've got guys in the back, then they can't hit people with melee weapons, but they're... You can use things like bows or daggers and throw things at people. But there's a neat thing where, like, you have different kinds of attacks people can do with their melee weapons, and some do more damage, but they take longer to basically cool down before you can use them again. Plus, the main way you avoid damage is by having better armor. You actually have, like, dodge out of the way from attacks before enemies can connect their attacks with you.
Right, you can step back. So if an enemy is particularly slow, you just go, all right, bye, and then they miss, and you're like, okay, it's time to hit you.
Yeah,
it's cool stuff.
Yeah,
it's nice that they really felt like, it feels like they thought about the real-time element. It's not a gimmick. It is actually a functional part of the gameplay.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine it's hard to keep running behind them and striking them in the back, but if you have the space to do that and you have the reflexes for it, then, you know, you can play this as, like, a really, really distant predecessor to, I don't know, something like Kingsfield or whatever. Well, which is probably one of the many inspirations that this game had. I mean, like, when I was checking the game out, I felt like I had played Dungeon Master before in the past, but at the same time, I was wondering if it was just another game that I might have played. Like Might and Magic is one of the ones I'm thinking of? I don't know.
I think Eye of the Beholder was a very popular take on this game.
That is something else we should probably bring up real quick. This has been a hugely influential game, and there are so many other games that have borrowed its ideas and tried different things with them. Cal mentioned Eye of the Beholder, and that's this game with D&D elements. A lot of D&D elements, exactly. Almost enough that you might actually need an actual rule book to really enjoy it.
you should, this game's, one of this game's strengths is that you don't need to know stuff like the D&D rulebook, so.
I mean, you've also got Lands of Lore if you want to, some somewhat better graphics, and the vocal talents of Patrick Stewart.
Make it so.
Always a bonus. I feel it's a bit wasted in Lords of Shadow, but that, we're not talking about that game right now. Continue.
But really, I'd say the biggest thing here is, here's the thing. There are so many games that needed this game to exist. Like, you look at Ultima Underworld, that's basically a single character, vastly upgraded version of this game, if you really look at it. And if you don't have Ultima Underworld, you don't get Elder Scrolls. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, or System Shock.
Right.
Same engine, though.
And if you don't have System Shock, you don't have Deus Ex, and you don't have Deus Ex, you don't have a lot of things, so...
That's true.
There's an undeniable amount of influence this game had, and it is, as I've mentioned with some other games in the past, a bit like XCOM. Sometimes the game doesn't need the elements from the game itself to just be like, yeah, but you know that the people behind these games, they played Dungeon Master, like, wow, just the way this game functions, just the way it is, it really inspires me to make games, not necessarily this game, but just... Like, trying to just take the feelings, the elements from this and make a completely different game. But, it's a very popular, hugely popular game. Dungeon Master was really big, sold tons and tons and tons of copies. Crazy, crazy sales on this one. Very, very popular. And very well received, because why wouldn't it? It's pretty intuitive. It's fun. It looks great. I'd say the music, not really that much. The sound effects are... spooky in places, and you know, that's cool. A lot of people didn't have sound cards in 88, so it wasn't a huge deal for it not to have lots of sound, even when it found its way to other systems. It did get music on some other platforms, though, so I guess does the Atari ST version have music? I don't remember, to be perfectly frank, but I didn't think it does.
I don't think so. I do believe that some of versions of this game have music. We should probably talk about that a little bit, because that's something a bit interesting. Super Nintendo version, it's kind of maybe not the best way to play this game, because this probably isn't like the best game to play with the controller. This actually has an exclusive version of the TurboGrafx CD, and that's got a few differences. It feels a little more, for lack of a better word, Japanese in how it's designed. You don't have one big dungeon, you have a bunch of smaller dungeons, and... you have one main character who stays with you from the entire game, but you swap out your party with each dungeon you enter, and I think it's kind of an interesting way to play the game.
But however you play it, it's really cool, and it would be remiss of us not to mention that this game has received a fairly popular, fairly well critically received fan remake, reboot, re-inspiration, whatever, in the form of... I was hoping someone else would jump in, there you go. Yeah, so Legend of Grimrock is basically this game, right? Like, I didn't play too much of it, but as far as I understand, it's basically this game. It even has options in that game to make that game more like Dungeon Master, I think. It has step movements and enemies locked into step movement as well. I think it has some elements like that. So this game's, still popular. People still like it. I got sidetracked ages ago, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the magic system, because it's clever, but it's also kind of a pain in the ass. Bob, yeah. Can you explain the magic system, please?
Sure. If you don't have a manual for this game, this is probably going to... Actually, no, not even the manual is very clear on this. Here's the thing. There are these... you have several different spells you can use. Some are wizard-based, and some are priest-based. They have different effects. The thing is, though, that you have to make them out of different symbols. They're basically syllables. And you have to take notes or have something that tells you what syllables make which spells, or nothing is going to happen. There is one spell that's basically translate to Ya Bro. I love that. And I believe that makes a poison resistance potion, if I recall correctly.
Don't look at me.
Maybe the purpose of Ya Bro was originally to be able to drink lots of alcohol without puking, and then be like, yeah, bro, have some more!
But, Ultima Underground took a very similar magic system, so it's clear that this game, it has very, very far reaches. But it is a great game. It aged very well, surprisingly. There are some other things, like I've seen Bob playing, and then a character got cursed or poisoned, and he was just like, I don't know what's going on. Why am I dying? Yeah, help, and then he dead.
That's another thing. There are a lot of things in this game that it's kind of a plus that some of these, this game doesn't bury you in stats, but in other ways it's kind of not as helpful, because like you find like a lot of different weapons and armor, but it doesn't tell you if it's ever any better or worse than what you already have, so you never know what you really need to keep or should probably just get rid of, and I feel that's a bit annoying.
It's also kind of interesting because this game has a completely opposite mentality to, loot-based games. I'll say Diablo 3 or whatever, because that's a new one that the kids play, but I think that Path of Exile, I think, is another one that's quite good about it. This game doesn't have that much loot. You know, you find an item in this game, you know, you find a new sword or armor, and you're like, whoa, I found something! Wow, cool, is it? And you'll actually, you know, you'll actually spend a few seconds looking at it, weighing it up against what you have, because, you know, it's kind of an event in this game to find a new item, because they're not as common as your modern games. You know, you just, it makes the loot actually meaningful, even if it's not always better. It's like, wow, cool, a new thing. Unlike a lot of modern games where it's just like, have some crap. I don't want that. Have some more crap. I don't want that. And, you know, I think it's refreshing to also to have a game which makes individual items meaningful, even though it is a dungeon crawler, and you expect those to have throwaway bits. Going forward, before we rank, does anyone have any little extra bits to say about Dungeon Master?
The game is certainly a bit antiquated, but it is also incredibly influential, and doesn't actually fail in holding up today. I mean, you know, the thing with the water is a bit of a pain, the thing with the being unable to tell what everything is, and like, you know, some of the tight corridors where I couldn't really strategically dance around monsters felt restricting, but, you know, this game really did codify a lot, as we said. I mean, I don't know if we'd even have, like, stuff like Wolfenstein 3D of the sort if Dungeon Master didn't sort of, you know, say, this is how a 3D game should look, go from here. And, I mean, I don't want to jump right away to ranking if anyone else has anything, but I want to say this one goes at least somewhat high due just to what it's done for gaming in general.
That's a good time to rank, because I don't think anyone's got anything more to add.
Let me make one more point before we rank. Actually, this does kind of segue.
Sure.
This is a... The thing of this game is it introduces the concept, but you could find games that do the same thing but better pretty quickly. Yeah. So, even if they're like the exact same genre, like something like, I don't know, Lands of Lore has a lot of nice features, like an auto map that would make this kind of a better game.
I don't know. The auto map is a complicated situation because Dungeon Master is not a randomly generated game, and you only have to draw one map, and it is grid based. This game is completely possible to take out your grid paper and your pencil and draw a map, because unlike when I was complaining about Metroid previously and a few episodes ago, not Super Metroid, the original Metroid, there's no like non-ratio spaces. You know, if you take a step in Dungeon Master, it's a step, and it's a single grid blip. So this game, you can map quite readily compared to other games. And, you know, automap's good, but this is a game of dungeon exploration, and I don't necessarily mind that there isn't an automap if you're, you know, if you're really getting into the spirit of 1980s dungeon crawler games.
Yeah, this is
maybe you need to break out of grid paper.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the sort of game that I think would be completely born for cartographers, just to sketch everything out where all the enemies and thingies are, and maybe even encouraging several playthroughs so that you have the optimal layout of things, which, I mean, you know, it would require some patience, but I think it'd be interesting to keep going into the game for research until you're ready to do, like, your I'm going to beat this run. Yeah, I find that aspect interesting.
I will say, in some fairness, though, I believe the game doesn't have a compass, which is a big no-no. there should be a compass.
Yeah, that sucks though. But what can you do?
Really wish I knew where
North was. That's the biggest deal killer for me. Like, I'm okay with making my own map. I'm aware that's just part of the genre, but I'd like to at least know which way I'm facing. That doesn't sound that unreasonable.
But I do like the idea that you can dump items and stuff on the ground to kind of trail your where you've been. And I think enemy corpses, do they stay?
I don't think so. I think they disappear after they die.
So it's just items.
Okay, let's really get to ranking this now. We've talked about this for a little while now.
I think so.
I think that it deserves to be noted for all it does, but we need to recognize that there are games that do better.
Do we have to? Every game that we put up on the list is like, well, yeah, but, you know, whatever. Sometimes we put games on the list that have been bettered in most ways, but, I mean, look at our number one at the moment. Super Mario 64 is probably not the best platformer ever, but it really codified the genre in a lot of ways, in a lot of very important ways, and the Dungeon Master genre is smaller, but I think it's really set the scene for a lot of first-person dungeon crawler-type games, but also first-person games in general borrowed heavily from Dungeon Master and its influences. Heck, you can find Dungeon Master in a lot of modern survival games that are so... maybe it's a little passé, maybe they're not as popular on Steam as they used to be, but boy, they were popular a year ago. Just survival, the jungle game. My God, there were like 1,000 of them. I didn't have a rank in mind. I was just talking shit about Mario 64. It's just something I like to do.
Come on. I'm just drawing a blank on where to place this. So you guys, you toss me a suggestion this time.
Okay.
Let's really make it difficult for ourselves. We have at number 29, we have Deus Ex, the famous PC game RPG. Cyberpunk. I keep thinking cybernetic, but that's what the guy is, not what the genre is. This is like, how do we smash these two together? Does Dungeon Master come out on top, or does Deus Ex come out on top? You know, because Deus Ex is the distant child of Dungeon Master in many ways.
I'm willing to let Dungeon Master go, like, just one space above Deus Ex. Just one.
Just one.
Just because I don't think you would have Deus Ex as we know it now without this game. Maybe we would have had it some way, but it would have been different at the very least.
I'm really dead on this faking, so I'm really just willing to agree with whatever. I would say maybe I was going to place it a few places lower ideally, because while the game is incredibly influential, it does also have that sort of catch that, like, what it's done, others have done better, so...
The tough thing for me is that Dungeon Master's direct clones, I think, are almost universally worse. Not all of them, but they looked at Dungeon Master and said, you know what Dungeon Master needs to be? It needs to be more complicated and more difficult to understand. And
I think that's a good point.
I think it's very impressive that in 1988, you don't get 87. I'm not letting you have this, guys. You cheating here. In 1988, you know, there was a game that was so forward thinking about that, you know, it's like, you know, our game can be intuitive, I guess we can do that. And the fact that you still had something like it took like more than a decade, I think, for almost all other games to catch up and think, huh, we could be intuitive. Especially in the genre. Like, I get platform games are relatively intuitive, but that's because, you know, you just run, you jump. Easy. Dungeon Master took a very complicated genre, a very complicated idea, and right at the, you know, onset of the genre went, yeah, there you go. Figure it out. It's easy. You can do it. You can do it, even if you're a kid, and I think that's pretty cool that they took that route. So I think it does deserve to be heralded in that way.
So you make a good point, but where exactly are we placing it? Still above Deus Ex? Is everyone still on board for that one, or Bob?
I hope Bob's still here.
I'm still going for above Deus Ex.
I don't know where else to put this, so congrats, Dungeon Master. Because we don't know.
What I think, and I think what will stop Dungeon Master from getting a little higher, so that we aren't accused of not sort of being fair. I think Dungeon Master's main letdown is that the plot is really not there. You know, you've got, you know, you got these cool characters like, hey, I'm the Lizard Man. And it's like, cool, what do you do? Nothing. Because
to be fair, there's like very few RPGs of that time on computers, I'd say, had like a really detailed plot.
That's the thing that bothers me, though, about a lot of them is, you know, some of them tried. They had, like, extended material, but there's no towns in this game, really. There's no, you know, you don't get to talk to anyone and develop a world or a story. It's very much dungeon. The dungeon is the game. You don't. But even your party members, even if they could just say something occasionally, like, boy, I don't like the look of this dungeon, right? Like, the game is evoking a sense of life and place, but it's a very lonely game. Even though you have a party of four people together, it still feels quite lonely. But are you saying that it should be higher?
Only one space above Deus Ex. That's pretty much where I'm solidified.
So yeah, so there's nothing else to be said. We're gonna put this one above Deus Ex. You know, it deserves it. It really does.
This game needed to exist for so many other games to exist as they do now.
Yeah,
I feel it's always hard to place this sort of thing when you have a game that is very complicated. It's a lot harder for a complicated game to age gracefully and also to hit all the right marks when it first came out. You know, when you hit the upper parts of the list, it's like, well, this game's really simple, but it works really well and it's timeless. This game isn't exactly timeless because it can be perfected in other ways, but boy, they did a lot for 88, 87, and, you know, it deserves to be recognized for that. And I hope, if you haven't played a dungeon exploration game of this type, Dungeon Master is still not a bad choice, but maybe it'd be better off with Grimrock at this point. And you'd be supporting modern indie development, so cool. Play either one. They're good and interesting games.
Yes!
Our next game is Shinobi 3, Return of the Ninja Master. It was developed by Megasoft and published by Sega. It was released on the Sega Genesis / Mega Drive, and its earliest release date and the region was July 23rd, 1993 in Japan. That was nominated to us by MDK2. Shinobi 3, Ninja Games. Ninja Game.
Gonna say something real quick. This is a game where you can have a ninja on a surfboard dive kick while riding surfboard so hard that he blows up missiles and bounces off of them, and you fight mecha while you're doing this. Number one, next game.
Well,
I got no problem with that, so excellent. Finally, a Sega game reaches the top position.
Alrighty. Stop from recording in that case. We should probably just say a little more so that the listeners don't feel ripped off. But in all seriousness, I want to get too ahead of myself, but this really is one of the finest action games on the Sega Genesis, if not of most action platformers I played. It's my quality stuff. I mean, it looks fantastic. It has all this rad parallax scrolling on it, just all these neato graphical effects, like especially in the third level. There's some cool stuff happening in there with all the weird body waste everywhere. It's a creepy level. And the soundtrack's, I think, really fantastic. May not be composed like Yuzo Koshiro like its predecessor was, but it makes the best use of the Genesis's FM synth that it possibly can. I should also say that Shinobi 3 is a little bit of a confusing title in a way, because it's known in Japan as Super Shinobi 2, which makes it the direct sequel to Revenge of Shinobi, also on the Genesis, which was called the Super Shinobi in Japan. So I guess it's Shinobi 3 because Revenge of Shinobi was supposed to be Shinobi 2 compared to the arcade game. But then there's the Shadow Dancer game, so this is kind of a kerfuffle. I don't know.
Thankfully, that doesn't really impact our ability to talk about Shinobi 3. So let's say I'd never played a Shinobi game in my life. What would you tell me that you actually do in Shinobi? Because I get that you're on a surfboard and you're a ninja, but what makes this game different to the other Shinobi games? What makes it different to other action games? Why is this game actually really good?
If I may speak for a minute, I'd say something this game does really well, something you didn't really see in too many action games at the time. You have a lot of mobility, and I appreciate that. You can grab on a certain surface and pull yourself up. You've got a dive kick that you can use to bounce off of enemies and then bounce off of other enemies and get a chain going. You've got wall jumps. There's just like so many different ways to move, and it's something that just makes the game control really well, I would say. It just feels great to control.
What I think is interesting is also that you're not punished for using these abilities. You know, it's more than just a double jump, and all of your abilities, you know, if you get hit, you get hit. You don't go blah, 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 and lose your ability to throw shurikens or lose your sword or something. You know, you have all of your abilities right from the start, and full health, no health, whatever, you are always maximum level ninja, which is, it's really cool that you just kind of have that power. And I think it's an interesting step from, you do have power-ups here and there. I think you do have your like full screen abilities, which I think you can collect more of occasionally. And I think you can get different shuriken or kunai types, which boost your ranged attacks damage a little bit. But for the most part, you are kind of at your normal level, which I think is really cool. And that this game has large-ish sprites on screen. They're quite large, quite well animated. But due to the way it sort of plays, I don't think it feels difficult. Like that you've used too much screen real estate on the character graphics, because it still feels fully playable.
I'd say it's pretty well balanced in terms of difficulty too. It's health power ups are pretty common. There's not too many places where it ever feels unfair. Maybe points where you're supposed to isn't quite clear, but it's not too much of an issue once you know what to do.
Yeah, what I really like about this game is that, and it's kind of notable with quite a few Sega games, especially post-90s Sega-published games, is that they were very clearly, okay, this is a home console game. You've already bought the game. We have your money. We don't care. You can actually finish this game, and we don't need to break your legs in the attempt. And I think that's really nice that you actually feel empowered in this game. You're a ninja, you feel like a ninja, and you can actually beat the game. And I think that's really cool compared to not just games on Sega and not just games on Nintendo, just games in general. This one actually feels, you feel strong and you can complete the game, but it still has some challenge to it, and there are bits that are difficult.
Yeah, definitely. Although you do only get, I think, like two or three continues to beat the game, which does feel a little restrictive, but at the same time, I think you can also set it down to easy, and you're not, like, denied, like, the last levels of the game because you picked the easy difficulty. So, you know, there's always things to get around it, and, like, you know, it's not a... Well, I don't know exactly how long the game clocks out in the end, but, you know, as an action game is, you can definitely beat it in under an hour if you're good enough at it.
Yeah, it's not a super long game.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it overstays its welcome, though.
But I don't mind that, though. That means
exactly
that all of it is good. There's very few parts of this game I would say are not enjoyable to play through. It's short, but it's all of it is worth playing.
Yeah, it doesn't have any filler to it. It really feels economically designed and full of boss fights, which I always appreciate in a game like this. There's always like a mid-boss every level and the big boss, which is like that giant like flesh monster at the end of 3 is just so awesomely demented looking. That's
one of the best bosses visually on the Mega Drive.
No kidding.
Wow.
Really gruesome looking. You wouldn't be seeing that in like early era SNES where they were censoring everything. So Genesis does.
Terrifying skeleton meat man. Pretty good stuff.
Not to mention the robot gods, the Mecha Godzilla at the end of stage 5.
Yeah, I like that. They got a little bit cheeky with getting their own copyright. Like, you've got gargoyles and guys in one stage that I bet has to be a reference to not Batman. Yeah. Plus, of course, Mecha Godzilla. That's not even subtle.
I think it's Lizardzilla, actually. I you know, you could have.
Well, yeah. They got into some bad business with comic companies, which are probably the most litigious entities on the face of the earth, if I had to say.
Well, Sega had different properties at various times. You know, sometimes they would have. You know, they'd have Batman or whatever, or they'd have Alien, and then they'd be like, well, let's just put references to it in our other games. And these companies would be like, hey, hold on, what are you doing? It's like, we're just putting this in other games, it's cool. I do like that, I do miss it a little bit. There's slightly more subtle references, you know, you don't feel like the gargoyle is Batman. You don't like, ha ha, you put Batman in your game. No, it's just like, oh, okay, I get it, you're just evoking a sort of similar sense. And there's a Predator-ish statues in one of the levels in the background, and it's just nice stuff that kind of visually sets it as, okay, yeah, this is an early 90s game. You've got all these kind of subtle call-outs and fun references that don't, you know, the Shinobi character, is this guy's name is Joe?
Yeah,
he's one of the...
Joe Musashi, yes.
Yes, he's Joe, Ninja Gaiden is Ryu, or whatever, you know, they've all got these bland names because they're ninjas and they're ninja people. You know, he doesn't ever like sort of stand up and say, haha, you got set up the bomb, like even though I think that would have been predating Zero. No, maybe, I don't know what year Zero Ring was, but
was older than this game. Yeah.
Would it also be unfair to say that Joe is kind of a better ninja than Ryu, because Ryu ends up just like completely blindsided by everything that happens to him, if you notice?
Well, you never plummet off a cliff and get murdered by a bird in this one. So
no, I would say that Joe is probably... I mean, I do like Ninja Gaiden better than the people who ranked it on our board. A little shady.
You like Ninja Gaiden more than me? You're a butt. I'm better than Ninja Gaiden.
Hey, come on, man. Let's not make this personal. We'll save the discussion for later. But no, Joe is just a straight-up badass. He runs, slashes, he dives kicks, he like just blocks everything. He can hold the fire button to block with his... just like putting two kunai together, and yeah, he's got a fair range of abilities there. I do question, though, the white and red color palette. That's not very stealthy for a ninja.
He's a true hero ninja. He doesn't use the element of surprise. He uses the element of kicking your ass.
Yeah, he's more like a ninja from like the... what would you say? The Godfrey Ho school of
ninja
movies.
Yeah, he is a Godfrey Ho super ninja character.
Yeah, exactly like that. But which is great.
Oh no, the ninja's here. I'm here and I'm gonna beat your ass. Ninja!
Exactly. It's like, I mean, I think Shinobi might have been born, actually, the original game, from that bizarre American obsession with ninjas being like super powerful, like god lords of combat, when, of course, in reality, ninjas were just like Japanese spies and they didn't even always wear the black outfits all the time. But
well, plenty of the enemies you fight in this game are ninjas and you kick their ass because you are the king ninja of ninjas. You're so ninja, you get on a horse and the horse becomes a ninja. That's just how ninja Joe is.
You can dive kick on the horse.
That's true. That's true. This game.
Horse, I give you. Hours. Let's
when I say that, I mean, you don't... The horse itself dive kicks people.
The horse dive kicks. It's fantastic. I like the idea that, you know, there was Ryo, and then he saw Joe in Shinobi 3 and was like, oh my god, this guy's kicking my ass. And then he hit the gym for like a decade straight, and then he comes out as Ninja Gaiden. It's like, yeah, now I'm ready, Joe. You and me, let's go.
And then Joe stopped being in games. Well, I guess he was a secret character in the PS2 one, if you want to get technical, but...
Joe. I think Joe was a victim of the fact that he's just a ninja. Like, at the end of the day, he's just... he barely is a character. It's like he's a ninja. He wears white and has red like boots. That's all he is.
Yeah, there may not be much to Joe, but I do like his design and I do like his game a lot. I mean, there's just a. I mean, I really also like this game's direct predecessor, Revenge of Shinobi, but if you only had to play one, Shinobi 3 really is a better version of Revenge.
I would say Shinobi 3 is the best of the series, probably.
I would say this too, to be honest.
Actually, that's not fair to say. I haven't played the PS2 ones, but definitely the best of the 2D ones.
Yeah, certainly the best of the 90s games by and far, and... I mean, I did like Shinobi on the PS2, but I'd even say this is better than that. It's just, I really can't think of too many faults to give to this one. Maybe except that the final level's kind of BS, you know, the whole, we forgot to put it on the floor, so enjoy jumping on these really narrow poles that sink into the void instead. But it's the final level, so, like, you know, I guess it would only make sense they ramp it up the difficulty like that. Like, if you hadn't mastered your jumps by then, I guess they're going to really put you to the grill on that.
So, let's start ranking. I don't want this game to leave the top 20. What do you guys think?
I love Sega games. I think that this game is more than a lot of other games. Firstly, it's aged fantastically. There's not a single element in this game that blindsides you, like, oh, that's crap and old. No, it's just, no. You could release this game right now, whatever, and people are just like, wow, what a great retro throwback game. This is so good. They added some modern touches with the way you control and stuff, but it's otherwise pretty great. And it's like, no, it's just, it has always been really damn solid and a great action game on the console that had a shedload of great action games. I think we've sold a lot of action games on the Mega Drive short. You know, we've put Alien Soldier, you know, not quite in the top 20. I think we may have placed it in the top 20 at the start, but it got pushed down a little bit. Poor Alien Soldier.
I'm just going to pass the buck to Xerxes in that one. I love Alien Soldier personally.
No, I mean, games are going to leave the top 20, and I think the thing with Shinobi 3 is it's a lot more approachable. It's just such, you know, it may not be the hardest game ever, but that works for it. You know, I think if we're going to put it somewhere, I'm looking around Donkey Kong, because we recently ranked Donkey Kong, and it's fresh in my mind. You know, this game is encapsulation of a lot of great things. I love that it's a very vertical action game, and it's an action game that isn't, okay, if you think like Contra, you think Metal Slug, you think these games, and even a lot of modern ones, they're kind of single screen in the sense they just kind of move left to right and the game will go up and down, but you're always kind of on a track. This one's interesting in that there's a little bit of platforming. Sometimes you go left and then you jump up around, you go right. There's a lot of verticality and the stages actually have some space to wander and feel like you're moving around, which is a unique flavor that I think was lost a little bit in action games to an extent. No, so
I definitely agree on that. I mean, while I do like, I guess, more treasure-like games are almost more akin to boss rushes, I also appreciate a game that like balances its combat with platforming and makes it feel like, you know, you got to be as agile as you have to be cunning. I mean, in the later levels, Shinobi 3 does ask quite a bit out of you, but it does have just a really,
it gives you more than adequate time.
Yeah.
Like, it gives you, like, by the time you get that far, you're probably, if not ready, you'll be there once you die and replay the game once. You know, you'll get there.
Mm-hmm,
and
definitely.
I think it's really just it's a solid, really fun experience from beginning to end, and there's no real bitch slapping in it. There's no, oh, this boss, he just instantly kills you. It's like, huh? Like, no,
nothing that malicious, definitely.
It's very cool. What do you guys think about Donkey Kong?
I'm okay with that.
I know you complain behind the scenes that we haven't really had any argument wars this episode, but
you want to get in a fight?
No, Shinobi 3 is too good. I'm definitely not going to do that over this game. I'm totally all up on making it that high. It's fantastic. Sega, congratulations. This is the reason why Joe Musashi is my favorite character in Sega Sonic and Sega All-Stars Racing Transformed. He's a really damn good character in that, too.
I can't believe he showed up in it, too. It's just like...
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, he's back. Joe's back. So that's...
They used the... They also used, like, the best song for Shinobi 3 as his theme, too, which I appreciate.
A great stage in that game, too, thinking about it. Lovely stage. Really fun. So that would be position 15 between Chrono Trigger and Donkey Kong 94, the Game Boy game. Just in case anyone's only tuned in for this episode, that is not the original Donkey Kong. That is the very impressive Game Boy game. But Shinobi 3 is a no-brainer. You should play it if you haven't. It is absolutely one of the pinnacle action games that it is just so good, and I have no complaints about it. The biggest complaint I think you could have about the game is that it didn't wash everything and it influenced a billion games. You know, it didn't influence as much as Doom or Mario 64 or I'm just throwing out like Super Metroid, games on the very, very top of our list. But it is such a fantastic game, and it's slightly overlooked, I think, as time has progressed. So definitely check it out because it's fantastic.
In the year 2027, the American Congress passes a poorly worded bill that inadvertently renders all video games illegal. Within 3 days, the entirety of the United States of America collapses into a post-apocalyptic hellscape. But for those of you lucky enough to live in the past, there's
still time to donate to the Hardcore Gaming 101 Patreon. So give now, and ensure that the only thing keeping you awake late at night
is the ever-present threat of Mecha Hitler's cybernetic human extermination squads.
It's nice to have peace of mind.
Our next game is Night Trap, and that was developed by Digital Pictures, published by Sega, originally for the Sega CD, because it's very, very, very original platform, the Hasbro Nemo, whatever it was called, didn't see release, so it came out for the Sega CD. Then it came out for a bunch of other things. It was out on the 32X, the 3DO, the PC, lots of systems. Its earliest release date was October 15th, 1992, and that is in North America. And this has kindly been nominated to us by BP Guimarães 23 on iTunes Brazil. Thank you for nominating Night Trap, because Night Trap is legendary.
Oh, for more reasons than one, I can tell you that. I don't know how much we wanted to glide on the infamous congressional hearings that this game was tangentially related to. I mean, I guess it's a story everyone's heard of by now, so...
Yeah, the interesting thing, Night Trap is a game that was infamous for being almost the video game equivalent of a video nasty. It was something like, oh, it's going to corrupt our children and destroy society. And it is one of the most goofy and innocent games you could possibly imagine. Even though the plot is a bunch of teenagers are taken to a house by a friend of theirs, and turns out the friend of theirs is a vampire and her family are vampires, and they kidnap people and drain their blood. And that's the plot, but it's such a lighthearted experience. Like, right. Very, very, very...
There's, like, no very, violence, no nudity, like, nothing objectionable, I'd say.
Nothing objectionable. There is a horrible theme song.
Well, I will...
cut into that right here. Start playing the theme song in the middle of our discussion.
Definitely get that theme song. Night Trap! Something like that. I'm sorry, it's not quite
so
burned into my memory.
It's a ripoff of Love Shack, if this is what you're saying.
I have no idea what it's supposed to be, but it is not a good song. And But yeah, so you are a member of the Sega Control Attack Team. I think that's the thing.
Oh my god.
Would you like to know what the acronym is?
Hey, they're ripping that off from that one Natsume game on the NES. I forget what the acronym for that was, but yeah, you can tell up front, like, this game is not serious in the least. It's just basically a playable B-movie in a way.
Yeah, and I think that's by far its most charming aspect is the game was originally filmed, the footage was filmed in the 80s and it was released in the early 90s. So there is a great deal of it's a very late release for an 80s B movie that accidentally came out in 92, which is this is fun and very interesting. If you're wondering if you're playing it on a non-Sega platform, it is the Special Control Attack Team or whatever. The acronym is always SCAT, and they always call themselves SCAT, and it's really funny. But
so it shows how this game plays. Basically, you are in charge of a bunch of different cameras and monitors.
You're placed in charge by SCAT, and you rig into a you connect to the family security system in a really fridge terror, fridge creepy kind of way, in that they've actually set up an elaborate security system which has cameras in all of their rooms, including the bedrooms and bathroom. And that was one of the reasons I think the congressional hearing kind of seemed like a good idea, is that if you read it on paper, you're basically spying on people in their house through their affairs, and you can go into all of their rooms. But actually nothing untoward really happens,
Wait. Yes. This game is totally the godfather of Five Nights at Freddy's. You think Scott Cawthon actually got some inspiration from this?
It's possible. It's a very interesting take on an FMV game, and I'll explain a little bit about that maybe a little later. But yeah, so you have these cameras, and the catch is not only are there cameras, but there are traps. So the game takes place at night, and you operate traps. What a great name, you know. Really, really captures the sense of the game. Yeah, yeah.
Right, give them a battle back.
The vast majority of the gameplay is ignoring the plot and jumping between the cameras and looking out for these destitute vampires, these nomadic homeless ones. They're called augurs, and for some reason, this family's house is absolutely infested with literally over, 100 augurs, I think, in the game. Like, there's so many of these motherfuckers.
And they look less like vampires and more like they're, like they're all dressed up for an S&M party or whatever. They just have these,
They're all in black. They wouldn't be out of place in a goth club, basically.
Yeah, they even have, completely black masks or whatever that, you can't see.
Okay, so the reason they do that is because they reuse the same footage about, I said 100 monsters, but I think there might be more, there may be a little less. But yeah, so these guys will enter the room that you're looking, and you'll see them, and they'll be like, da-da-da-da-da. They'll sneak around the room, and then you'll have a little bar down the bottom, and it'll go up and down, and it'll say, trap. And the idea is that's supposed to act as a kind of hot and cold system. And when that trap meter reaches full, you press a button on your controller, and then it will activate a trap, and a slapstick hilarity ensues, and a bed will flip up and it'll push them into the dresser, and then the dresser will collapse and they'll fall into the prison or the inferno or whatever. Like, there's not specifically tells you what happens. It's just a bunch of steam flies up and it goes, and then they disappear and you count them as trapped. And there's lots of these. Sometimes glass cabinets fall. Sometimes the walls twist. Sometimes the ground opens up. The stairs become, very, very classic. Stairs go from stairs to ramps. Whoa. And they fall down in holes. It's very, very fun stuff, visually very fun. You will see these scenes enough that at some point you'll be like, yes, it's that scene again. Very funny. But there is a phenomenal one where a guy gets catapulted off the top of the house into a pit, off the side of the house, which is absolutely genuinely hilarious. And reminds me of, Power Rangers sort of style, special effects where they just kind of spring a guy clearly with, an upwards camera angle. And it's whoa!
It's almost like live action Scooby-Doo of some sort. I don't know how far off base that is, but
it's pretty close. So what happens is that the main impetus for you is that if you don't trap enough of them, you will eventually be told by your scat commander. He'll be like,
this situation's getting out of control. I guess you're not good enough. And then he'll just unplug the game, essentially.
Two other things I feel I should point out. Yeah. One, and here's the killer. You can, in most versions of this game, I'm not sure if they change this in later versions, you can only see one camera at a time, so you constantly have to be flipping through every single room, looking for anything that might be happening, and it does not give you any time to watch anything interesting that might be going on.
It's like, one of the bigger criticisms, I think.
Like, yeah. There are times you're going to have, the family members hanging around, having conversation, singing into a hairbrush, taking a shower. You don't get to see that because you have to keep paying attention to all these empty rooms that eventually happen in.
They're in the shower and I can't look because I got to trap these stupid organs. I can't believe this. This is bullcrap.
There's some cool stuff that happens. Sometimes what an enemy, the augurs, will move between screens. So they'll appear on, say, the upstairs corridor, but you won't be able to trap them. And then they'll walk their way to, say, the stairwell, and then you'll be able to trap them on the stairwell. So you actually have to change cameras to keep an eye on them to get them when they can be trapped. Now, one of the chief gimmicks is, of course, all these cameras are rolling in real time. And I do mean real time. There's not really any way to pause the game and look through all the cameras. You actually have to look, and every time you look, it takes a few seconds to change camera. Originally, the Nemo, the original system that this was going to be developed for, was a very strange VHS video hybrid system that was actually able to play multiple video tracks at once, and the idea was that with Night Trap it would just seamlessly change between video. And the later releases of Night Trap get the transition time to pretty much instant, so you don't lose very, very much. But the Sega CD, you lose a little bit, because the Sega CD is not the greatest CD thing ever made, but it works. So the idea is, I think it's supposed to be replayable. I think that's the complimentary to that, is that you play this game and you're not supposed to be the first time, because I think it's only like 25, 30 minutes long, in terms of strict length.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those practice makes perfect sort of deals where if you did know what to do on the offset, you know, the game would feel like a bit of a ripoff. So in a way, they kind of want you to get your money's worth. Not like an adventure game where you like slowly learn and write down where the vampire thingies show up and you know, what you have to do in order to apprehend them, and that's only something you can do through multiple playthroughs until you're ready to piece it all together in one fell swoop.
And it is, and you know, like, the more you, as you switch cameras, you start to actually remember. You're like, okay, at 3 minutes, there'll be the augurs here, so I just go to them, I'll trap them, and then you go back to the story, and you're like, yeah, there'll be more augurs in 20 seconds. I can watch this part of the story. And sometimes they'll have multiple story tracks running at the same time, so you can't physically watch both. You actually have to watch one or switch between them rapidly. And it's actually really cool, I think, personally, to have this basically a story that's been told in real time from multiple perspectives that you actually get to see, which is uncommon for movies and uncommon for games. It's a very cool idea, I think, even if the game doesn't always feel like it's working all the way there. It's pretty cool. And to catch you out, and this is a real gotcha in this game, every so often, and it never changes in terms of the time when it happens, but every so often the characters will change the code for the security. So there's about 5 or 6 color codes, so you've got a button that changes what color code you're using. So
Real quick, this is going to be a funny story, which I kind of complained about the game, too. A very long time ago, back during our old G7X days, I live-streamed this game for the Sega CD video, where I played a bunch of the most notable Sega CD games. I don't know if I was doing well, but they were about to change the code, and Snarboo said something at that point, and I could not hear if they changed the code, too, and, you don't... It does not tell you again. If you miss it, you're just... That's it. Too bad.
Now, in the game's defense, you aren't supposed to be having a bunch of assholes shouting in your ear when you're playing the game. So is kind of a bit, but you know, you are supposed to be paying attention. And it's kind of cool because they recorded a different recording. So they'll be like, oh, we should change the code to red. So, you know, the different codes is randomized. So you do actually have to pay attention to that and get the correct code each time because it will change, which, you know, you're talking pre-recorded footage here. And they tried really hard to actually in some way make it work, which I think is really, you know, you got to give them props for putting effort where they could, because the CD speed of the Sega CD is not fast enough to stream video instantaneously. So I think it does some tricks with the way that the video is laid out on the discs so that you can actually playback things quickly. And I think it might actually be, that's why it can't reshuffle the sequences. They have to always be kind of the same order, which is, yeah, it's okay. And there's another little thing it does, which is there are moments where you have to trap enemies or you will lose because they'll kidnap one of the main characters. So cool stuff. Sometimes you're not supposed to trap characters. Again, you know, they try, and I think it's kind of, for an FMV game, trying to actually be a little different, I think, is a very, very noble goal, especially when they didn't necessarily have to be, especially when they originally filmed the footage. Having said that, where do we put Night Trap?
I'd say it's maybe somewhat more of a game than Sewer Shark, at the very least.
Yeah, I'm not going to question that. It does actually require a bit more thought in what exactly you have to do, and I don't know. I almost want to say this was possibly the best FMV game on the SCD, which, you know, I still don't know how highly it should be ranked as a result of that, you know, on top of the King Turd, as they say, but you know, in premise, I don't think this game is actually that bad. I mean, it's heavily flawed in how it actually works, and it can get kind of repetitive to keep, keep notes of where all the various augers pop up and whatnot. But this is one I can say they definitely tried, and the results do come off as amusing, if nothing else. So, with that, where
it's a fun little interactive movie that tries a little bit more than being a multiple choice sort of thing, which I think it's a noble goal. There aren't many games like Night Trap. There's Night Trap, and there's its pseudo-sequel, Double Switch, and that's pretty much it for the genre, until you move to Five Nights at Freddy's, which unfortunately hasn't inspired other games to make something that isn't Five Nights at Freddy's, but immensely worse. Stop making Five Nights at Freddy's clones, kids. I'm sick of it. They're not good.
Ah, what a soapbox. Well, if there's any place to say that, this would definitely be the place.
No one's nominated for FNAF, but if you do, I actually don't mind that game, so I would rank it reasonably well. But having said that, look, I'm going to highball Night Trap a little bit, because it's no secret. Maybe I really like this game. I'm gonna highball it right here. Here we go, above Master of Magic. That's it's about number 81 on our list. Mm. I know that seems high, but I it depends where you go with what is a game, what is a movie. You know, can a game that is basically a movie be challenge other games? And I think that it's a lot of fun in terms of. It's got fun characters, it's got fun writing. The gameplay actually tries to incorporate the concept of FMV really well in a way that doesn't feel like it's messing with you. It tries to keep... The replayability is maybe not great, but they really thought about how do we make a game replayable that's just a bunch of videos strung together. And I think that's really... I think they got most of the way there to a coherent experience.
Hmm. Well, you do make a point, but I definitely wasn't looking that high when I wanted to place it. It does have to be said, though, that this game is very cheesy, and unless you RTFM, probably not immediately easy to know exactly what you're doing in it. but...
Well, there's very few... In its defense, there's almost no gotchas. This game very, very, very rarely will throw anything like, you know, oh, actually, you were supposed to do this in terms of controls that you didn't understand or bizarre moon logic that you don't understand. It doesn't do that because it doesn't have the capacity to.
I guess that changing code is kind of the worst it gets in that way.
And the changing code is a nice idea, you know, to try and actually keep you flicking around, which is
okay. All right, this is I am nonetheless going to lowball it a bit more and see what you think of me placing it theoretically between Lethal Enforcers and Clash of Steel.
I admit I'm okay with that. I just don't have quite as much seething contempt for Night Trap for whatever reason.
Yeah.
See, in my opinion, Night Trap is more fun than Lethal Enforcers. Crucify me if you have to, but actually, I really think it's more fun.
If you wanted to place it between Ninja Gaiden and Lethal Enforcers, I can work that out. I'm just not placing it above Ninja Gaiden. I'm sorry. I have to draw a line somewhere, man.
I get it. Ninja Gaiden is an important game. It's pretty good. I've already said I like Night Trap more, and that's mostly me, and I get that. You know, I'm the kind of person that has a hard drive full of crappy movies from the 70s and 80s, so Night Trap is a very special game to me because it has all those elements that I look for, and it's a very fun experience. It's not the best game, but I feel it's almost a mandatory game to play because it's just so... It's an interesting game, and it's not going to take much of your time to try it. Bob, what do you think?
That's all right with me, honestly.
All right.
If I can't move Bob, it's going to have to go below Ninja Gaiden, because there's...
I'm okay with this. Go for it.
Okay, between Ninja Gaiden and Lethal Enforcers, which I still think is higher than it would rate on other lists. So,
well, other lists suck, and that's why our list the objective games, 57,858 games of all time, because it is correct.
Yeah.
And this is where Night Trap is apparently going. As I said, this game is so worth playing. Even if you hate it, you'll be like, well, at least I never played a game like this before. True. Unless you played Five Nights at Freddy's, in which case... what can I say? Five Nights at Freddy's is an alternate take on the idea, but Night Trap's really cool. If you like Night Trap, there is Double Switch. That game is quite good as well. It mixes things up a tiny bit, so it's quite good. And it's got the... Is it now the deceased Corey? I can't remember if this Corey's still alive or if he...
Corey Haim?
Died recently. Yeah, maybe.
We should probably say R.E.P. Dana Plato, Kimberly from Different Strokes, who is actually one of the characters in Night Trap. She died all the way back in 1999, apparently. Damn. But...
Night Trap is... that's... What can we say? It's... It is an interesting game, and I like it, but
yeah.
You don't have to like it. You really don't, but it's fun. It's a different kind of fun.
I'd say even if it's not your type of game, it is definitely worth a check, because absolutely nothing was like this at the time. And I would say it is probably the least sucky of anything fully FMV-based. I mean, you know, it's either this or Make My Music Crisscross or criss-cross. Whatever.
And you got the Mocky Mock one as well, I think.
Oh, God.
One more thing before we close out. You really, really want to see this game, but you just can't just get yourself to play it, there are several attempts on YouTube to try and turn this into a movie, so just Google Night Trap the movie and keep an eye out for one of those.
Mm-hmm. And if you open your heart to FMV games, you could check out Her Story, which is another good FMV game, and recent.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. I haven't gotten around to it yet, but it actually does look pretty interesting.
Yeah, so I like games that take FMV, and sorry to keep rambling on about Night Trap, but this period of 1992 and FMV games on the Sega CD, people legitimately thought that this was where games were going, you know? People were like, whoa, games are going to be like this, and Night Trap is maybe guilty of causing some of this, where people poured so much money into FMV games that it was a terrible idea.
Multimedia!
But at least Night Trap's good.
Well, it was a good attempt. I mean, we did get the Tex Murphy reinvention out of it, so, it wasn't completely all for naught. It was just kind of a noble failure, if anything. Love is easy by the hard day. Keep the
That's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to at Jacko Jarvian and at MDK2 on Twitter and BP Guimarius on iTunes. I apologize if I pronounced any of those names wrong, but come on, help me out here. Thank you for nominating those games, and thanks to those of you who we didn't get to yet, we will be getting to you soon. Thanks as well to my lovely co-hosts and co-patriots, our editor Jeff Rude, our theme song composer Muteki, our technical assistant and video editor Bobinator, and of course, the support and feedback of listeners like you. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101, by subscribing to the Hardcore Gaming 101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG101 on Twitter. But most importantly, help us claw our way into podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or we'll never find out who's left all this freaking cheese all over the dungeon! Until next week, keep keeping it real. I like that joke. That's very funny.
There is so much cheese. Like, who's eating it? The monsters?
It's like these monsters is just like lactating everywhere, and it's like becoming cheese. Like, is that what's happening?
Jeez.